Welcome to The Created Life. The Created Life is a podcast featuring insightful conversations with people living life by their own rules and making a positive impact. I'm Damian Taggart, serial entrepreneur, wilderness guide, poet, and author, and I'll be your host on this journey. The Created Life is an episodic dose of inspiration, life hacks, and engaging ideas to help you grow and create a life you love. Welcome back to The Created Life. On today's episode, I speak with one of my favorite humans, definitely a person to watch. My guest is a man known as Ryan Fu, who plays at the game of life by his own rules. A man who celebrates his journey of personal and spiritual growth by incrementing a version number. Whenever he feels that there has been a significant amount of change in his life, he simply releases a new version. When I recorded this interview with Ryan Fu was in version 4.9, but as of now, he's actually in version 5.0. So if you happen to see him, you're talking to Ryan Fu 5.0, not 4.9. Ryan is an entrepreneur, founder of the Black Actors Guild, and a very inquisitive and introspective thinker. He's someone that goes out of his way to make a positive impact in his community and to bring some light into the world. Before we get started with the interview, I just want to give you a quick announcement and to congratulate you, because if you're listening to this, that means that you are still alive. That means that you are graced with choice. You still have ample opportunity to be more today than you were yesterday, to forgive, to create, to be more expansive, excited, and passionate about what you bring forth today. This is a public service announcement that you are free. Within the confines of your socioeconomic and historical moment, you are free. And that because you are still alive and able to listen to this podcast right now, you have the great good fortune of being filled with that vital energy that animates the cosmos, that mysterious force of creative will that underlies everything. And that force is yours to express however you see fit. If you hate something about your circumstances, pay attention. Don't accept a life of living death. Do whatever it takes to change those circumstances. Even if it kills you, do not accept a life that is less than the life you want to create. This is your time, and every breath is a rival. In other news, my new book is now available on Amazon. It's called Little Book of Mountain Prayers by Damian Taggart. Please check that out, and without further ado, I hope you enjoy the show. Well, thank you so much, Ryan Fu, for joining me on The Created Life this week. It's a pleasure to talk with you, and I'm interested to get into, to learn more about what's going on in the world of Ryan Fu, and I believe we're at version 4.9.
That's right.
Do you want to tell me a little bit about the version number?
Sure. So I don't think you know this. When I was 18, I got into a car accident and forgot my entire life.
Wow.
So Ryan Fu 2.0 came out of that, and it became very clear to me that...
So you had long-term amnesia.
Yes, kind of. I don't remember. And like since then, and in meditation, I can remember ages 15 to 18 pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But there's people I run into from high school all the time that are like, oh, we were really good friends. And I don't remember them at all,
right.
Which feels terrible, but it's just my experience. So sorry. But I don't remember anything before 15.
That's crazy. That's like a crazy story.
Total yeah. blackout. So the versions of Ryan Fu, or my inception of that, began in that moment. And since then, a lot of building, and there were landmarks at 3.0 and 4.0. So being a new dad and sort of moving into this next tier of entrepreneurialism for me is we're on the edge of 4.9. I'm actually, technically, I shut down 4.9. So servers are offline right now.
Okay.
Our user base is waiting for us to come back online as 5.0.
All right.
Excited to release all the new content.
That's cool. So since you bring up this story, I have to ask a couple more questions about
anything,
it. So
anything,
the... What was the experience like for you emotionally to lose your long-term memory?
It's great because there wasn't one. It was very nice. It was very nice.
Like freeing.
Oh, yeah.
Liberation.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
It's hard to say, really, because I don't remember what it was beforehand. But I do remember waking up in the hospital and feeling very light. Mm. And I remember people coming in who are my friends or someone I had loved or a mom or a dad and them being very concerned and me just not understanding why they were freaking out. I was in a car accident, but I was fine. And like the moment was good and the nurses were pretty and they gave me good food. So like, well, what's the problem?
So was your passion for theater, did it come before or after that? Or was it, do you know?
It came before.
Okay.
My passion for theater was really more about my friend group, interestingly. Uh-huh. So the Black Actors Guild actually came out of Denver School of the Arts, which is a pretty popular public-private magnet school here in Denver. Mm-hmm. You have to audition to get in and blah, 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 blah. There was only about 800 students there for both middle and high school when I went. So not a lot of people. And not very diverse. So for the theater class that was in the same class I was, which was the graduating class of 2010, there were five African-American students in the same class. And that was more than in the rest of theater or maybe the school combined.
Yeah, that's kind of like my school in high school too.
So we became the Black Actors Guild. That was just my friend group. And we took over the Black History Month show, which was going to get shut down our junior year. And we produced two shows that were very successful and sold a lot of tickets. And so by the time we got to college and we're rehearsing stuff at the University of Northern Colorado, we were like, let's drop out and do this. So we dropped out and we did what we had been doing in high school in real life and have been doing it ever since.
I always love a good dropout story that ends in success.
Yes. Like,
so many of my friends, I don't know how so many, but a lot of my close friends have been dropouts or like basically dropouts and have found paths to success. And I think that that's actually an interesting story that needs to be told more because I think a lot of people grow up with the kind of values that my family had where it's like, go to college no matter what, even if you have no reason. Like I didn't have a plan for going to college. I didn't have a career. I wasn't like on a track to be an engineer or something like that. But it was just like, you need to go to college.
It was required of you.
Yeah. And I think like, if nothing else, like taking time off would have been a huge advantage for me. Like,
yes, but it was the same for me. Just so it's clear. It was a cardinal sin to drop out of college. I went from living on college dorm for a year and my parents told me, if you don't go back to college, you can't come back home. So I was homeless for a year while I figured out what it meant to be an entrepreneur. Mm. I was breaking laws left and right because I always made sure we had an office. So I had somewhere to sleep at night, slept with friends a lot.
Right.
And just grinded through really, honestly, what was my first experience of poverty.
Right.
So I value that time in my life, which was a dark but really beautiful time where I had to appreciate rice and beans.
Sure.
And never got food stamps, which actually looking back on it was very foolish. I definitely
like should have.
Definitely should have done that. But yeah, I loved it.
That's cool. So the other thing interesting about the story is that you really started your professional career in high school, which is like, I think that's maybe a bit of unusual. In some ways, it's kind of a head start. It's an interesting path to be on. So just so the listeners know, So you started the Black Actors Guild as this project in high school. It's grown since then. You've done it for how many years now?
Ten years.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And was there any gaps in that 10 years or has it been going strong the whole time?
It's going strong.
Wow.
There were four cardinal members that started the Black Actors Guild and two of them are actually dead now.
Wow.
I don't know if you know that.
I did not know that.
So Corin Chavez died in 2015. Is that right? 2014? I don't know. Time is not a real thing. Anyway, Corin Chavez died in 2014-15 and Nick Thorne died in 15-16. So there was a lag where suddenly our two top creative content producers who were writing shows and developing sketches and filmed our online web series, which were all huge hits, they were suddenly gone.
Mm.
Like very suddenly for both of them. And so there was this evolution that did take a little time, but was very good for everyone.
Totally. And what is the guild up to now? Like, what are the kind of projects you're working on?
Sure. So we're an arts education company, which means that We produce content. We just finished a show called Mosque, and we teach in the schools. I would say reasonably about 30 to 35% of our revenue, what pays our staff and whatnot, is production. The other 65 to 70% is teaching in schools, professional development, that kind of stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And so tell me about this production that you just wrapped.
Sure. Oh, it's so good. I'm so happy with it. I haven't been executive producer on a full show for a while, just I've been so busy. It's been a year or two. Mm-hmm. No, it hasn't. Honorable Disorder is exactly a year. And I forget how much I love it every time. So this last show was called Mosque. It was a story of a Palestinian American father and son who run a bodega in New York in 2010 when the mosque was being built near Ground Zero, and it became a national controversy, right? Don't build the mosque next to the Twin Towers.
Sure.
And so it drew a lot of hate, but also it was one of the four times in the last history there was a spike in hate crimes.
Wow.
So it documents this story of them trying to, well, for the main character, for Muhammad, it's really about, am I Muslim or am I American? Am I hip hop or am I Arab? And that cardinal conflict, I keep saying that word, but it's true, that like meaningful, inherent, unchanging conflict is what drives his whole play. For the father, it's about what does it mean to be, because he's the most American character in the play. He listens to Stevie Wonder all the time. He's always watching Clint Eastwood movies. He's like, his whole shop looks red, white, and blue all over the back, the front of it, which you don't notice until halfway through.
Wow.
He's more American than a couple of the characters who are characters who come out of the hood who are super against the mosque. And it's super curious to watch his sense of identity as an American and his sense of identity as a Muslim come at conflict. Because there was a time, not so long ago, and maybe even today, where you cannot conflate those two, right?
Sure.
Right. So that is it. And then Mo deals with the opposite conflation, which is, I may be Arabic, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm Muslim. And that's the conflation he deals with.
So it's really like focusing on identity. And that's something that I wanted to ask you about too, is like the, you know, theater itself as a medium is really it's a medium that inherently is always speaking about identity, because even just the act of being in a production, you're taking on a new identity. You're acting, you're pretending to be something that you're not.
Are you?
I don't know. Well, this is a question for you. So yeah, maybe I'm leading too much in the way I'm asking.
No.
Just, I'm curious about your thoughts about theater as a medium, and what is theater? And I guess where my thinking goes is like, is identity always theater?
Great question. So I love to refer to these conversations, which is great because usually I have to bring it up, through a book that a popular theater philosopher called David Mamet wrote. Mm. The book is called True or False, and it deals with the notion of, is acting lying? Is it pretending to be someone? Or is it becoming someone so much that you're telling the truth? Mm. The answer is both and neither. David Mamet takes a really curious approach in saying that you can't pretend to be anyone. The worst actors do that. So like, can you pretend to pick up a cup of water and drink it? No, you can't do that. Right. Are you ever so convinced by somebody on stage? Like, let's say someone is playing Albert Einstein, right? Is there ever a part of you that's ever tricked to think, oh my God, Albert Einstein never died. He's right in front of me. I should kidnap him and help him solve nuclear energy for the world. No, you never are, right?
Right.
So the question is, what's really happening? And Mamet believes, and so do I, although I dislike the word believe.
We'll get into that next.
Sure. he talks about how acting is a kind of magic, right? Does the magician ever really magically move the card through your hand and into the deck? No, right? But it certainly seems like it.
Right.
So to the person who does not know how the magic is done, it certainly is magical, right? Mm-hmm. But to the magician, maybe not so much. So that to me is the starting point on which you discuss what is character. And I love acting because there's a deeper spiritual question, which is, and this is the question Mamet poses, do not ask who the character is. Ask who is the actor, right? Mm. Because the character, you could say, is something Stanislavski might say, the character is something the actor puts on. It's a costume.
Right.
Mamet would say, there is no character. There's only the actor. And when the actor has certain objectives, pursues certain intentions, uses certain tactics, they appear, just like a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat, it appears that they've become this person. But it's not happening. It's just that you're doing the magic trick properly. Yeah. And that is the most beautiful thing, because it's this complex paradox of not trying too hard and doing what the character would quote unquote really do, which really just means what the audience thinks is truthful to that archetype or mythologue in that moment.
Mm.
And playing with those things. And as a director, which is, I did do some directing on Mosque, and I was assistant director for Honorable Disorder, the show we did last year. The director's role is, they call it a play for a reason. It's to toy with those things and to say, well, try it this way. Or, okay, maybe you're not mad at him this time. Let's say actually you really want his approval. And you see the actors go about it these different ways, and suddenly this truth reveals itself through that play. And you go, that, do that one all the time.
Right.
And then there's a different thing. So that, I hope that answers your question.
Totally.
But it's such a lovely and interesting art form to observe, because it's just, I think, a bit more nuanced than a painting. I don't mean to put down the giraffes, but you know.
It operates on more dimensions, perhaps. Yeah.
Yes.
It makes me realize that I need to go see more theater and actually more performance in general.
Most of it's very bad. I'm going to be honest with you. I love theater, and I go out to theater sometimes and I'm like, oh, this is a dying art form.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny. I mean, I don't know. I think it's been a while since I've been like a frequent patron of actually enough art in general. I think that's my excuse has been being a dad, whatever. But, you know, I think.
When's the last time you were at a museum?
Let's see. The last time I was at a museum.
It was a while. Were you blown? Do you remember being blown away by?
It was maybe a month or so ago. I brought my kids to the Denver Museum of Art and Science.
Okay. Nature and Science?
Yeah, Nature and Science.
The dinosaurs and stuff?
That's right. Nature and Science, yeah.
So that one's actually pretty decent. But were you like super blown away in the way that an immersive Meow Wolf experience or your favorite movie? Were you blown away in that way?
No.
Okay.
It was crowded when we went, and it was like spring break. I don't know. So I was removed. I didn't like lose myself in it. Yeah.
I feel like all of the canon concepts of art are getting boring. And even in theater is the worst example of this. I think museums are actually pretty bad too. I think that's why Meow Wolf has had some of the success that it's had. People are tired of going to exhibits and looking at art on the wall that somebody painted from the 1800s, doesn't have diddly squat to do with what their life is like, that represents one really specific point of view, and then they go home.
Right.
And they're probably not going back if that ticket costs $25. But you give them an immersive experience like Meow Wolf, I'll use other examples later, but it makes them feel things and make them explore things that they think, oh, I could do that again, and that was meaningful to me in a way that is applicable to my life. I think theater is probably the worst out of all of them of being too canon. So if you're a theater person, like, I'm tired of seeing Death of a Salesman, and like now the musicals are really popular. So I wonder how many times Wicked has been performed. Have you ever seen Wicked?
Nope.
So it's the story. It's a cute story.
I know of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a story of for your listeners, the witch. It takes the protagonist becomes the Wicked Witch of the West,
right,
as opposed to Dorothy. And it turns out actually Dorothy in this storytelling is sort of vindictive, maybe evil, and is sort of running a PR campaign against the Wicked Witch of the West. Anyway, they do a really good job of it, but damn, I've seen that. Like, it has to have been performed maybe a million times in the last 10 years.
Well,
it's everywhere.
Actually brings up for me a bigger question. It's not just a theater question. It's like, how many times do we just have to have the same creative IP regurgitated to us? Like,
it's profitable.
Yeah, no, that is the answer. That's the end of that conversation. But it's like,
I don't want it to be though.
And it's a shame.
I think that I was at the Denver Center for Performing Arts, a vision board with them, and they were asking, how do we get young people to go to theater? mm-hmm. because they're having a really curious problem right now, which is literally attrition. Their audience is dying.
Right.
Literally. Right now, the average patron is 67 at the theater.
Wow.
That's no good for your business model. Because it means 10 years from now, half of your audience is gone.
Right.
That's brutal to say, but it's the truth.
Right.
And so they're asking these questions, how do we get younger people to go to theater? And they say, well, we'll do social media campaigns for our latest theater show. And we'll make sure the cast is more diverse. But the truth is that they're not willing to change what stories are being told.
Right.
And that's the core issue. People are tired of hearing other people's stories that have nothing to do with them.
Right.
And that's why our show Mosque was so successful. It was about a Palestinian-American father and son, but I never explained it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I said it was about a family in New York.
Sure.
And everyone who came to it felt like it was applicable to them.
Right.
Whether they were Muslim or not, whether they had knew anything about it or not. And that's what theater is meant to be. It's meant to center you in the shoes of the protagonist. I think that's what all art is totally. Trying to do. But when capitalism gets a hold of something,
mm-hmm.
capitalism is very afraid to take risks because the investors say, well, it's been working. It's got a certain ROI.
Keep baking the bread.
Yeah, keep baking the bread.
Yeah, totally.
So you know that's the answer.
Yeah, for sure. So let's dive into that a little bit. Let's talk about you and the Black Actors Guild from the entrepreneurial standpoint.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about capitalism. And yeah, tell me about, is Black Actors Guild a nonprofit?
No.
So you're a for-profit.
And I'm glad we're not. Yeah. It's a purposeful decision.
Totally. So let's, you brought up Meow Wolf. That's like kind of the last company that I helped start. And they're definitely not a nonprofit, although they have some social impact.
Imagine how much it would have hamstrung them if they were.
Totally. I mean, yeah, absolutely. There was very intentional decisions made around.
Very good.
How can we actually have the greatest impact in the world that we live in? And it's
by getting investors, by selling equity, by doing all the things a for-profit company could do.
So is that part of your strategy for the Black Actors Guild? I mean, you see it as a, tell me more about it.
Like, yes.
Yeah. Your vision.
Yeah. The short answer is yes. As we work with, so Mosque was written by Jihad Milheim, who's a local, really fantastic writing and IP we won't have a stake in, like to put it in mm-hmm. capitalist terms. Honorable Disorder was a play written by local Jeff Campbell, who again is part of our company, part of Emancipation, and IP we have stake in.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't get to do that and hold on to that stuff and create content that we want to sell to Netflix, Hulu, so on and so forth, and entice investors and, you know, blah, 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 get loans from banks if we're a nonprofit. We just don't. We get to apply for grants.
Right.
And we get, like, sponsors are a little easier to get. But the rest of it is.
And if you follow the nonprofit money, it's usually derived from capital enterprises, like capitalist enterprises that, you know, so it's like wealthy donors that are giving money, or it's, like you say, grants that are usually set up by foundations that are essentially just like philanthropic arms of something else. It's it's oil money. It's something else, you know?
I mean, who does Bill and Melinda Gates invest most of their money in?
Right. I don't know.
It's alcohol and firearms.
Oh.
Because they have to invest. When you're a giant fund foundation, you have to reinvest your money in the stock market. And then you use the dividends from those stocks to pay out most of your stuff. That's why they have the money they have.
So that's where the Black Actors Guild is putting their revenues.
Right into firearms and liquor. No. We don't make that much money, you know?
We make enough
to pay
six
or seven staff members, and I am thrilled. It makes me feel like the mastermind to be able to help put together something like that with
it's truly a remarkable achievement, actually, to create an organization that, you know, supports a small community of creators. You know, I think that's great.
You know how it feels.
I know absolutely how it feels,
I imagine it probably feels better than being the CEO of Amazon.
Hmm. I have no idea. I would try that on for a day and see how
I imagine you might not make it through that day because I'm not sure it feels good.
To be Jeff Bezos, who knows? I don't know.
I don't either. I don't mean to judge him. I'm just saying that I don't take for granted I'm an anarcho-syndicalist at heart.
Sure.
You know, I'm read a lot of communist books.
What is that? Just define it real quick.
Sure. So I get that phrase from Noam Chomsky, who talks about anarcho-syndicalism as a form of anarchy. It's anarchy. And the idea is that if we had syndicates, so you could call them tribes or villages or states, that didn't have an overriding governmental structure, but were ran by the people. Mm-hmm. So no one had, there was no leader, really. But there were villages, little groups of people who ran their own things, and then those villages worked together, that would be a perfectly fine way of governing the, you could say, federal government.
Sure.
Like how the Native American tribes worked before America.
Let's zoom into the idea of capitalism a little bit, sure. Because I think that's a term that gets thrown around a lot.
It sure does.
And I feel like it often doesn't, it's like, it gets thrown around on one side as being sort of a force for good, a force for like innovation and the driver of sort of progress of society. And then on the other side, it gets thrown around as sort of a term that's symbolic of oppression, hierarchy, control, and even kind of the rape of the earth and destruction of resources. And I think that, you know, clearly I think there's realities on both of those sides. And I think so when we talk about capitalism from the lens of it being a bad thing, what are we really talking about?
Well, I think it's the things you mentioned. I think it's the recognition that the interplay of scarcity and who holds the resources drives value. I think it's a recognition that perceived value ends up being what things cost, not their value, which is I'm allowed to curse, right?
Sure.
It's a kind of mind fuck of its own to just imagine that, you know, the price of a candy bar has nothing to do with what it costs to make the candy bar and the materials and the people and
It's
what the market will bear, right? Mm-hmm. So some of it's economics more than it is capitalism. But I suppose when we talk about capitalism, we're saying that the philosophy of economics becomes the religion of capitalism, which is that you are legally obligated to make your shareholders money.
Mm-hmm.
So Amazon doesn't have a choice. They don't get to decide, well, we're going to be ethical and take a $2 billion cut this year and make sure our people get paid more. They don't get to do that.
Sure.
Because the people that own the company are stockholders, and the stockholders have one goal.
Right.
And that's profit. So I think that when I think of capitalism, I know there's this corporeal, spiritual consciousness mm-hmm. who is kind of like an AI. It's a robot that's programmed to do one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does do is allow you to create the maximum utility for the resources you have, albeit half of it makes stupid things and half of it gets wasted. But on the other side, you consume way more than you need, and it damages without any regard for people or the planet.
So is there a way that we could, or if you were, so I think a lot of conversations that should happen don't happen, but especially between people who have
capital,
opposing views on whether capitalism is a force for good or evil, or sort of, you know, a negative force.
What do you think? Do you think capitalism is good or bad?
Well, so what I think is that we just put too many different concepts into the word capitalism. And so when somebody says capitalism, they're actually, it's such a shorthand for so many different ideas.
Yeah, absolutely.
That what we're really doing is not having the conversation that we need to have, which is, There is it for me. It's not like capitalism is good, capitalism is bad. For me, that's like baby talk. That's like goo goo gaga. Like, let's talk about what's actually really, what is at stake, you know? And I think what you're pointing at is, I 100% agree with, like, the idea that the unchecked profit motive for shareholders is a problem. Like that clearly is a driver of harm in society. And so I think, like, that's something that would be great to talk about. But on the other hand, I also think that, like, the profit motive is also a really great motivator for humans. And so I think that there is, like, room for it also. I don't think so. For me, it's more nuanced. It's like,
what if you could have that profit motivator, but you capped it? So let's say Amazon can make, how much is the company worth?
Many billions. I don't
know. Many billions. Probably reaching nearly the trillion mark, right?
Sure.
Like hundreds of billions.
Mm-hmm.
What if you were allowed to make that much money, but the actual money that could get paid out to staff and stockholders was capped at like $150 million?
Sure. I mean, I think that could be a good...
And then what do we do with all that excess money? We would funnel it into society and programs and, you know, homeless shelters and food for everyone and curing diseases. And
sure.
And so that drive to like be as successful as possible could be alchemized into something really useful.
Absolutely.
But is it? No.
Yeah. In my view, I think that it's like we're always going to be... For me, it's about shifting consciousness in the people that not only work for businesses, but the people that own businesses and right. saying like having a sense that if I'm doing something that's oppressing you, even if it's just economic oppression, like which is what most of us feel, you know, is if I'm playing a role to economically oppress others in my community, then I'm actually hurting myself. It's like we've been kind of told this story of like, each man for himself, kind of right. the Hobbesian sort right. of...
It's a battle royale.
Yeah.
Get yours and leave the others in the dust.
But I think, I think that's what, that's created the world that we have today.
Yeah.
And it's a competition is not a bad thing. Competition has a really good qualities to it. It keeps people sharp. It does move things in a positive direction. It's like unchecked competition where we're like, I have no compassion for you. I have no connection to you, where I've completely othered, made you into an other, that's so for me, it's like Jeff Bezos, all those people, like how do we get them and, to start seeing that if you're acting as an oppressor, like you're actually hurting yourself, you're hurting like the whole planet.
That's kind of dangerous to me because I hear what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder because is the only way we get rampant capitalists to agree with us and be nice to people is to admit that it's good for them. And like, I get it. Like one of my favorite forms of altruism is what they call selfish altruism, right? Which is like, I do nice things for you because it makes me feel good. There's nothing wrong with that
right.
at the end of the day. But I imagine what Jeff Bezos would want to know is how do I contribute to your oppression as little as possible while making as much money?
Right.
Or not hurting my payroll as much as possible.
Sure.
So long as that's the paradigm. And I think that's what people refer to when they say capitalism, the paradigm of morals versus profit. So long as that paradigm is always in flux, I am not interested in having that conversation with them. But I've got my wife's ex-fiance, which is a weird thing to say, who's a friend of mine. His name is Jeff Orlowski. He's very successful. Look him up. He did two documentaries on Netflix. Oh my God, I forgot the name of them. It's about the coral. It's the one about the coral reef dying.
Chasing Coral.
Chasing Coral, yes. And then Chasing Ice is the other one. He's very successful. Won Emmys for like best environmental doc.
Is it Ben
Renzo? No, his name is Jeff Orlowski.
Okay, Jeff Orlowski.
But I think Ben is someone on the project. But he's the director and wrote like sort of the script and storyboard. I'm sure he works with other people. But he won an Emmy for... best environmental doc, and he was like, "Oh, I didn't get best documentary." I was like, "Shut up! You won an Emmy." Anyway, it's a
so you were judging, you were being judgmental,
absolutely being judgmental, falling out of my center, returning to humanity. He said, "All the rich people he talks to are absolutely interested in these issues.
Totally,
they realize capitalism. It's a late stage capitalism crisis mode. None of them have any idea what to do, and they all feel like no one's willing to talk to them."
Hmm.
So I hear that. And I know there's a part of that reality that's true.
Well, let me change the. I hear what you're saying too, and I don't think that there's like I'm not a spouse. I never espouse that there's one way.
No,
there's
no.
many ways, and anything that I'm saying is really that we need to be more nuanced and more focused. As like, let's talk about specific policies and specific things that we're going to do in action instead of like living in this world of gods and demons fighting each other. Right. And so, but it's an interesting question to me. Is like. If we like, what does it mean to be moral is one of the things that I think about, like, so if we're handed like an example is like, here's the Ten Commandments. It's this external thing that you are handed. And so are you truly moral if all you're doing is following
the rules?
And I feel like the same applies to business and the same applies to like the law. Like if the only reason we're not murdering each other is because of the law and like police.
Right. Have we really grown?
Are we not murderers?
Yeah, like, absolutely.
And so that's just a question. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I actually gave you my answer before the podcast, right? I said that the difference between the mind and the self and others is really rather negligible. They're both external forces. If you're willing to go down the rabbit hole of consciousness, mm-hmm. which some of our listeners might have already done. So congratulations on being enlightened.
Maybe they're in the rabbit hole of consciousness.
Yes, there they are. They are the rabbit hole. No, I joke. I think you surmise your question for me for a second so I can get a really specific answer.
Sure. So are you moral if you're just following some external thing?
No. But also words are stupid. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting caught up on the word morality. For me, I know that when I do something wrong that I'd consider wrong, I don't like the duality of right and wrong.
Sure.
If I do, I feel a type of way mm-hmm. that really haunts me, right? Like if I steal somebody, which I haven't done, I don't think any of, but if I don't give a friend back a thing they lent to me, right? Mm-hmm. I feel a kind of way that tells me, I can't do that. And I have to give it back to them, right?
Do you ever get road rage?
I don't get road rage. Yeah. Are you a road rage person?
I used to be.
Oh, okay.
I'm over it.
No, I don't get road rage. But I do get frustrated sometimes, like with my partner.
You?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. And and we have to work through that. But I think that your internal compass has all of the mechanisms for determining morality.
Sure.
You don't need to teach people morality. They're people. They know what it feels like to have done something wrong. I think that's actually one of the mistakes of modern concepts around morality, and one of the reasons I dislike philosophy in general, because it makes everything so we can write it down and that's the way it works.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's not true. Intuitively, human beings have a compass. There's probably a million indigenous myths and stories that tell that like you don't need to know what's right and wrong. You know what's right and wrong. It's a feeling inside of you. And it sounds silly to say, and I know there are some people that are such skeptics of humanity that they would say, if you remove the Ten Commandments, if you got rid of laws, if you took all external validation and morality away, people would turn into murderers and thieves. I don't think that's true.
No.
I think it's closer to the opposite.
Totally.
So that's my take on it.
No, I think it's very interesting. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about the fact that I think it's often used in the opposite way, that as we externalize values, as we externalize morals to written code or philosophy or ideology, then it often is used to justify immoral behavior.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely, right? I mean, name it.
Yeah.
Name it.
Totally.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting dichotomy that we've created for ourselves. So back to the business thing, just to wrap it up.
Like, please do.
My feeling is that we need to listen and teach ourselves to listen to that internal compass and not give our power up to all these external things and say, tell me what's right and wrong. I'm just this little automaton following orders. You know, like to me is like the problem.
Absolutely. You know? Or to look up at them and say, you're not following my sense of morality, which is trying to oppose your own external sense of morality onto someone else.
Absolutely.
And then wagging the finger and in that way, giving up all of your power. I've got a fun little anarchist way of taking things back.
Let's hear it.
Using capitalism. It's a little radical, but not too much. It doesn't involve Molotov cocktails or violence or anything like that. So let's say we decide ExxonMobil has had a good run. They're polluting the hell out of the planet. They don't pay their people well enough. They're making a lot of money. It's time to end that, right? Well, we could solve that, I'd say, in probably about a month. Here's how you might do it. You gather everyone in your state and you create a kind of coalition that is the Let's Take Back Exxon Coalition, or whatever you want to call it. And then you find out what Exxon is paying everybody and what they're charging everyone for their bill. And you divvy it up and you first make sure that every person that you're paying at Exxon who does a job, you're going to pay everyone except for the CEO and the shareholders. You might even pay the CEO, but less. And you decide a fair wage for everyone, and you then calculate how much money everyone's paying in bills. What you'll find out is that if you take the total you're paying everyone, actually people are paying probably like 5 to 7 times more in their electricity bills than the people are getting paid, right? So you shave that off the top, and it's a win-win for everyone. So essentially what you tell everyone is, look, you're now, instead of paying your Exxon bill, you're going to pay it to this coalition. The coalition will send the money to the workers. The workers will continue working, and no one will pay their Exxon bill. And what will happen is there will be a public takeover of a utility.
Hmm.
The workers will get paid more. People will pay less on their bills. And I imagine if there were any issues with your with the functionality of electricity or people not trying hard enough, that worker efficiency would go up too. It would be a win-win-win-win-win-win-win across the board. The only people who would lose would be the stockholders. Would that have some side effect that I can't think of because I didn't take Economics 305? Probably. But it's possible. It's possible for people to get together and say, we're tired. This good job. That was nice. Mm-hmm. But we're done now. And now it's ours. Thanks. Goodbye. And you could technically make everyone a quarter of a 1% stockholder in whatever this new thing, if you wanted to use capitalism metrics.
Sure.
But I don't think you need to. I think when you make it, I don't think people conceptualize how much waste there is in profit. And as soon as you start recognizing that, and you start paying for things in what they're worth, and it allows you suddenly to pay everyone better and for everyone to pay less for it, and people are going to go, what were we doing?
It's ultimately a concentration of wealth issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's interesting to like trace that. Well, actually, let's switch gears. Let's talk more about Ryan Fu and what Ryan Fu is up to.
Sure.
So what else are you doing right now?
I run this recording studio. So that's a thing.
The pod space.
Yeah, it's where we're sitting in physically right now. It's a place in Denver, Colorado that my friends and I built. Shout out to Steven Sampson, a wonderful human being, very clever man. And we took a building that is going to get bulldozed in 4 months now, actually.
Oh, so it has a deadline.
Though. It had a deadline before, mm-hmm. but it was kind of a gray deadline. But no one would sign the lease, so we said, let us take it and pay very little and make it a recording studio. And we've recorded, I think we're in like the 300 mark
for nice.
Podcast.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a fun space to be at just a few times, but yeah.
So I do that. Cool. I'm a new dad. That takes up half of all of my time, as I'm sure you know. I'm a consultant, so I do a lot of consulting work, telling people ideas. I didn't sign an NDA, so I can say this. Ha 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 ha. I did some consulting for the museum the other day, the Museum of Nature and Science, actually, which uh-huh. we were talking about earlier. And they were asking how to create a new immersive exhibit and gave us a day's worth of facilitation to think of it. And I came up with a natural disaster escape room, which could be both educational and so I do stuff like that and immersive.
Cool.
Like the flood water is rising. What do you do to survive kind of thing?
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Anyway. I love that kind of stuff, so I do a lot of that creative consulting.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's great. So...
Oh, and I run these men's groups.
Yeah, tell me about the men's group.
Which you do now, too.
Yes, I do.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. So tell me... Yeah, so you're in your fifth programmed men's group, right?
I think we're in our seventh.
Seventh, okay.
Sixth or seventh. Yeah.
So how has that experience been, and why did you get into it?
So it's called Brethren. I got into it because I have spent a lot of time... My wife is an indigenous woman. Utimia Cruz Montoya. She goes by Muse Medicina online. You can look her up. She holds all these really beautiful spiritual spaces for everyone, but mostly for women, because that's where like 80% of the spiritual community is female.
Mm.
You could relay that to a lot of things, but some of it's toxic masculinity. And the husbands of people who would go to these spaces, the boyfriends, the men who were there, were always asking me the same question, which is, Where are the men's spaces?
Mm-hmm.
Where can we go to have any sense of ritual or belonging? And I never had an answer, so I made one.
That's cool. Yeah, and I mean, it definitely inspired me. I mean, I haven't been to any of your men's groups yet, but maybe this weekend.
Yay.
But just even seeing your posts on social media and kind of the intention behind it, it definitely inspired me to, you know, sort of try to get something going in Santa Fe as well. And
thank you for doing that.
Yeah, it's just been cool. And I think... For me, it was like a lot of just my own experience as a man felt like there are just conversations that I, you know, still haven't really had a chance to have with men or, you know, in a free kind of way about, you know, masculine identity, about, you know, male sexuality and like all these things. It's like, there's a lot of work to be done there. And I think, you know, so just diving in and figuring it out as we go along is...
It's what life's about, man.
It's a privilege to be able to do that and be able to facilitate those kinds of spaces.
A pleasure to sit next to you and hopefully for you to join on Sunday.
Yeah.
Quick aside on that.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen any like Joe Rogan podcasts?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So honestly, like, and I think it's pretty decent sometimes, and sometimes he does stuff and I'm like, eh.
Sure.
And that's me personally. But I heard one guy the other day talk about how he loved Joe Rogan, and a woman bashed the hell out of him and was like, Joe Rogan's this and that, and why would you listen to him? And he had this guest on one time, and they were anti this and that, which all might be very true. And he responded very simply, which is, well, there's no other space for me to listen to men talking to men about things they might not otherwise discuss in broader society or with women.
Right.
And I was like, oh, well, that highlights the need for the men's circles pretty valiantly.
Totally. Yeah. And I think it's like, you know, it's challenging a lot of the assumptions that kind of that have turned into toxic masculinity, like, you know, challenging the idea that men shouldn't cry, don't have feelings, like, you know, need to be a certain way.
Or should do it alone.
Totally. Yeah. And I think, yeah, it's just like, I think, you know, that's another thing that actually been on my mind too, is one thing I want to start piloting as well is just a humans group. Like, what can I get men and women together and have a different kind of group with the same kind of intention of just like creating a safe space for anyone to come together and to start having dialogues that essentially just creating a container for people to connect in a different way. And people who don't have any necessary connection to each other than I've got something to say, I've got something to communicate. So that's another thing on my mind, because I think, so back to what Ryan Fu is up to though. tell me more about your experience becoming a father, and what would you say to people who are on the fence? Should I have a child? Should I not have a child?
I will defer back to the callback of what I just said, which is follow your own internal compass. Do what feels right. If you're like, well, I don't know, I guarantee you the part of you that doesn't know or is conflicted is your mind. It's your brain. It's the voice in your head. You know exactly what you want. How you get there, whether it's meditation or yoga or stillness or drugs or however it is you choose to get there, go ahead and get there. But you know what you want. For me, I knew. So I this is almost embarrassing to say, I prayed for my partner. I prayed for someone that was older than me, was in their early to mid 30s, was a powerful, magical sorceress of a woman who would teach me all kinds of things, and very specifically would help me to find my own sense of being pretty, of being beautiful, of like dressing well and like doing my hair.
Nice.
And it's so silly to say that, but she happened along like 3 days after that really specific prayer.
Wow.
So when she came into my life, there was a part of me that was just like, anything you want, you know? And that didn't work out so well. But when it really came to what she wanted, in sort of like the second incarnation of our relationship, and we're going on 3 years now, the first year was not really what it is now. Into year two, she decided, well, I do really want to have a child. And I said, cool, I want to be sober. Like, I don't want to smoke weed. I like barely want to drink coffee. I want to be as clear and as present and as mindful as I can be, to be a hollow bone, as they say.
Yeah.
And then we can have a child. And that to me was more important than the impetus of having a child, but it was plenty. And now I'm just psyched to be a father. It's wonderful. It's tiring. Mm-hmm. It's trying. I don't have a lot of childhood trauma. I think maybe because I don't remember any of it. But any issues I ever had with my mom or my dad, I see immediately becoming a mirror in my wife being a mom and me being a dad.
Yeah.
I know that's the case for her. Like, as soon as she started becoming a mother and were pregnant, all of her stuff around her mom came up. So I think if you're interested in like that next level spiritual journey, childhood's the thing, man.
Yeah.
Child rearing.
Yeah. And childhood's pretty good
and
too.
Childhood's awesome too. Although I couldn't tell you.
That's right. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
And sad.
It's not sad.
No,
it's not
I'm
sad.
Just kidding. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not sad.
Some people say that a lot, though. They say like, oh, don't you?
How sad.
I don't know. High school sounds like it was pretty terrible for most people, so.
No, totally. I mean, and what I, yeah, I'm pretty like ardent about not focusing on the past, you know, like the past is what it is.
And doesn't exist.
Let it go. Yeah. So if you don't mind, I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about your own kind of spiritual views, because it sounds like, you know, you talk about things like praying, you talk about things like, you know, you reference a lot of just a lot of concepts that seem to pull from a lot of different places. What is that journey like for you? I can get more specific if that's
No. It's a great question. I'm just trying to answer it in less than 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Let's start here. When I was young, I don't know how young because I don't have a good sense of memory, but when I was younger, I do remember my mom always being a really, her and my dad both grew up, I think, Christian Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, a little bit less specific. But they were really indoctrinated into that, and as such, they both rebelled. My dad became more of an atheist. My mom became a crystal-loving, chakra-opening, non-practicing yogi.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I rebelled from both of those.
Mm-hmm.
So to give you a strange sense of dichotomy, I was never really an atheist. I always had this sense of things, but I didn't like the faux fake, I'm super into rocks and I buy hemp spirituality.
Sure.
It felt so inauthentic to me. So my journey has always been one of finding the middle ground of those things and being really authentic to my experience. And what I've done since then, and since my car accident really, because that's where it all started.
Mm-hmm.
Because I woke up and people were calling me Ryan, and I was like, what does that mean? And they're like, it's your name. And I couldn't really conceptualize having a name, and then it became clear, like, that's what you call this body. Okay, cool. But like, I'm not really the body, because the body was doing things before I arrived, and I don't remember what it was doing. So there was a sense of consciousness exploration. So since then, I've explored, I'm willing to say, 50% to 60% of all religions. Never being a devout anything of any of them, but just a visitor.
It's like visiting services and reading texts and
absolutely
things.
Yeah, the whole nine. And through that found Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell, who I would say, if I have anything near to any religious belief, it would be the teachings of Jung, mm-hmm. and Campbell, which I think are also dated. They do feel like they're from the 60s and 70s because they are.
Sure.
But
concepts like collective unconscious and
totally.
Things. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And they were way ahead of their time, mm-hmm. right? Like this, it's so easy to say these days, like, we're all one, man, and like post it on Instagram. But they were talking about it in a way that was really counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where like it sort of took root for me. And from there, I saw the necessity of practice, of yoga, of meditation. Mm-hmm. I'm still deep in my meditation practice, but as you can tell, I'm a little bit thicker than I used to be pre-dad.
Well, you know, the Buddha wasn't known for his physique.
No, he was not. No, but he's a cool dude. So but I'm getting back into that. And I think that also my wife being indigenous, so this magical lady walked into my life, right? Mm-hmm. And her being indigenous connected me to all of these archetypes and mythologies I'd heard about through Jung and Campbell.
Sure.
All of these different tribes and peoples who were not what they referred to as the desert religions, right? Which is Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, which were all born out of the same, like, you know, sort of Christ mythology, or Catholic mythology of the desert religions of the promised land.
Mm-hmm.
But all these different, I think you could call them pagan or indigenous traditions. And being in those rituals, going to those ceremonies, has changed me in a way that is profound. And so now I don't feel like I believe anything. I don't feel like I identify with any particular spirituality. I'm just enjoying my life and this is where I think spirituality is heading. I think spirituality is going to become a kind of technology. I think people are sad and disconnected and they're lonely, and they want to take a pill or watch the right movie or pray
get the right job,
pray to the right God and be relieved of these things. But there's this other inner form of searching and of what I'm willing to call technology that can get you there. I think with a pretty high rate of success. I don't think it's yoga for everyone.
Totally.
Or meditation for everyone. I think it's going to look different. For some people, it's therapy.
Sure.
For some people, it's mind-altering drugs.
Skydiving.
Skydiving, yeah. For some people, it's working out. But for me, that's the path. So I will say this, my deepest divings, other than Sufism, has been Taoism. And I love the esotericism and the nuance of both of those, because neither of them really say what they are.
Right.
They're these really mystical kind of like, you know, what is the Khalil Gibran quote? Like, forget not that the wind loves to play with your hair and the sunshine longs to touch your skin. It makes you think like, oh, wait, like this isn't all about me.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. His writing is great.
Oh, God. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like orgasmic. It's wonderful. Totally. And same thing with Taoism, right? It never says what the Tao is.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Tao? Oh, it's neither up or down. It's neither left nor right. It's not even center, because the opposite of center is not center. So the Tao can only ever be, I believe Lao Tzu says, the Tao can only ever be touched around.
Mm.
It can never be touched. And right. So then you think, well, what's the point of that? And you start exploring and you realize, ah, that's what they're referencing.
Right.
And that's why I can't explain it. As somebody who, and this feels so stupid to say, but as somebody who has lived in that place and aims to live in that place permanently, or remember that I do already,
mm-hmm.
I'm constantly weary of putting any word on it or pointing to it too directly, because it feels a certain way inside of me, and that is all I care about.
That's beautiful. Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
Sorry for that long.
No, answer. That was really good. I'm just like processing it. So
it was less than 30 minutes.
One of the things, no, it was actually succinct on many
okay,
levels.
Okay,
the, I'm interested in the idea of prayer too right now. You mentioned that you were praying. And what is praying? How do you pray? What does that look like for you?
Great question. So it is simultaneously three things. And this is a hard one to describe to people, and I'm very careful about who I say this to. First, so there's three types of prayer, I would say. The first is a prayer to something greater than you, and that prayer to something greater than you is a purely religious kind of phenomenon. It's the idea that you should be subservient to this other thing, and I do that sometimes. The second type of prayer is a purely psychological kind of thing. It's a letting your subconscious free. It's a releasing inhibition. This is a weird thing to say, but people are good and bad at praying. If you go to ceremony and you hold space and you open up, all right, cool, Bob, step forward, give us a prayer, right? Certain people will be like, thank you for the air.
Mm-hmm.
And you think like, wow, this person's not very deeply connected to what they're grateful for or for what, they have a hard time expressing it, right? Some people are like,
or they're stumbling over the social anxiety of it, or
totally, yeah, totally. Some people, like Theo Wilson, who you had on just moments ago, will just like poetically break into that. And there's like an intuitive. Some people are talented at that. Some people are not. But there's that, right? Which is a kind of a psychological Jungian phenomenon. And then there's a third type of prayer, which is a recognition that you are God, that all things are God, and that prayer is a way for God to talk to himself, herself, itself, a way to
love that.
To bridge the greatest sense of consciousness and the most specific sense of consciousness, for them to have a conversation. And that's what I try and do.
That's great. Yeah. That's cool. So let me ask you, what are you most proud of in your life?
You asked this to Theo, and he was like, well, I don't really know, and I don't either. What am I most proud of? Just shooting from the hip here, I would say I'm really proud of being an entrepreneur. Like, I'm one of those social justice warriors that hates capitalism, and boy, I'm also a gamer. And the sense of accomplishment from having done well in a game that is very difficult is unparalleled. It feels like I'm not done. I'm still a kid, you know?
Totally.
I'm 27. And so when I make $35,000, $40,000 a year, I feel like a baller. And also I'm not tied to the 9-to-5.
When you're doing it through, you're following your own vision, which is more than most people can say actually at any point in their lives. You know, people get stuck in, they stay at the Texaco job or whatever, and they never get past that for whatever reasons.
Yeah, yeah. And some people are forced to because of physical disabilities or whatever.
Absolutely.
So I'm very lucky too, and I recognize that. But I'm most proud of, so let me amend that. I'm not most proud to be an entrepreneur. I'm most proud to pay my friends.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that, so that was today actually for me. Was that? Yeah, that was today. I took a nap. So I'm, was that yesterday or today? Today?
Paying your actors.
Yeah, yeah. I got my Eventbrite payout from Mosque,
mm-hmm.
Which was, I think, because some of it's already paid, it was like, you know, it wasn't much, it was like $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as it came in, I got this giddy sense of like, oh, I get to pay my actors and my stage manager, and I get to make sure everyone's taken care of. And, you know, I get to ask you, do you need cash, or I'll get it to you however you need. That makes me really proud.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's like, I mean, that's totally fundamentally like, I think when business is being done right, there is a great sense of pride of like being able to create jobs for people, of being able to uplift a community and being able to create opportunity and stuff. So I think, you know, I think it is multifaceted and that's cool. So, is there anything else you wanted to throw into this conversation before we kind of like wrap it up, or how are you feeling?
I just want to say thank you. I love you. And I appreciate your interest in consciousness and the randomness that brought us together.
Yeah.
And I very much like spending time with you.
Likewise. Yeah. Thank you so much. I really, you know, can reflect that right back at you. So.
Awesome.
The final question, and I know you know you're ready for it this time, is something I've been asking all of my guests, which is, if you could implant one practice or idea and it would spread virally to all people, what would that be?
Yes. I could cop out and say listening.
Mm.
I think what meditation teaches us is that there's so much noise, and that the more noise there is internally and externally, the harder it is to listen to. What a strange paradox, right? Because it just becomes static. But when you can find moments of peace and stillness, when your mind is not, and I feel bad for people because I know for most people, they have never not heard that voice in their head saying something. It narrates their day constantly.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason it does that is because it feels like it's not being listened to. It's the inner roommate that feels so abandoned by
you. That's fascinating. Yeah.
So if you can listen to it, it shuts up. Then you can listen to the world. And you realize that the world in your listening is not trees and wind and rain. Actually, there are omens waiting for you.
Mm.
There's a whole, I don't want to be too particular and turn certain people off, but what people call God is reality. It is talking to you right now. If you are listening to this podcast, then whatever you consider God, the sentience that you identify with as being conscious yourself, is talking to you through this voice, through this podcast, through your meals and through your partners. It's talking to you everywhere. But if you don't cultivate the listening it takes to get there, you're going to feel lonely. So if you do, and if I could give everyone one thing, it would be that kind of listening.
That's amazing. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And that's not a cop out. So you're good.
Oh, good. Glad to hear.
You have my stamp of approval.
Thanks.
Cool. So where can people go to find out more about the Black Actors Guild, about the Pod Space, about Ryan Fu as the consultant and father and entrepreneur?
All over social media, all those things, you just type them in. They all have their own websites. You can check out our show and all the testimonials it got. Even though it's over, we might put it up. MosqueTheShow.com, BlackActorsGuild.org, RyanFu.org, because we build Ryan Fu's. That's our thing. You can see all the patch notes updates as the new one comes out. I wear yellow framed glasses, I don't. My Ryan does. And as 5.0 comes out, we're moving to purple. So if you want to see what life looks like for a purple Ryan Fu, you can check that out. Check out my wife, because she's incredible and has a much larger following than me. She's really successful online. Muse Medicina. There's the internet.
Cool. Well, yeah, we'll have to get her on the podcast too.
Oh, she'll blow your mind, man. She's incredible.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much. It's been great talking to you. I'm sure I'll talk to you again at some point in the future.
I am absolutely sure you will, and I'm sure it will be just as wonderful.
Thanks.
Thank you. Have a good one.
That's it for this episode of The Created Life. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends about it or support us with a donation. Also, please let me know what you liked or didn't like about the show, and if you've got a suggestion for an interview or topic you would like TCL to cover, you can send a message to Damian at Wildest. That's Damian at WILD.IST. See you next time.